Hello, my name is Chip Lang, and you are listening to Total EM. Once again, I have Fritz Fuller with me, this time for a rule rant. Now, what these are, we're going to take one or two or a couple of subjects, however much it takes, and we're going to talk about some issues that we have with different practice settings, especially in the emergency department and rural areas, but this can apply to other aspects of other fields. And we're going to talk about things we don't like about it, but we're not just going to complain. We're actually going to try and give some ideas about how to make this better too. So Fritz, since you're still relatively new to the show, do you want to introduce yourself again?
Sure. Fritz Fuller. I'm an emergency medicine physician assistant with the Division of Emergency Medicine, the University of Utah, and also a longtime rural and remote practitioner, currently working per diem shifts in southern Vermont and upstate New York.
Now, we do have to mention here, because I thought this was kind of cool and maybe this will tie in with everything, you have some pretty interesting, well-known colleagues, including Mike from the Ultrasound Podcast. You want to just mention that real quick?
Sure, yeah. I mean, if you're just getting into ultrasound, it's an incredible resource to get smarter. And then the challenge, of course, is finding like-minded people that you work with to help you get better at the practical scanning aspects. But certainly it's a treat for me to be at the University of Utah. There's a lot of really smart faculty in our ultrasound division within the emergency medicine department. The other two faculty that probably don't get quite as much airplay but are fantastic educators are Patrick Ogresy and Jimmy Fair. It's been a real treat to do bedside scanning with patients with real pathology. And of course, I'm very fortunate being in this setting, but undoubtedly, wherever you work, there's somebody out there who's into ultrasounds, and sometimes it's the ultrasonographer themselves, but there's people out there that want to help you get smarter and are like-minded. You just have to make the extra effort to seek them out.
Hopefully, I talked to him in the past, and unfortunately the expense was just not something I could work with at the time, but hopefully soon I can do the Ultrasound Leadership Academy.
I've actually had a few colleagues that have gone through it. It's simply an amazing way to become smarter and more proficient at learning ultrasound without necessarily trying to take a year off of your life and get into a physician-level ultrasound fellowship.
Perfect. I have to start off with something that drives me nuts, and this is about night shift. I love working night shift. I love the group I work with. The atmosphere and environment is great. There are very interesting things that decide to be emergencies at 2 a.m. Always entertains me when I have someone who has a chronic complaint that comes in at 2 a.m. Not really changed, but they just want to come in tonight because they feel like it's an emergency, which maybe sometimes it is. A lot of times it doesn't really end up being much. You know, sometimes you also get the interesting accidents that happen at night. You know, when the bars close at 2 a.m. where I'm at, all of a sudden the drunks are out and they aren't going to call an Uber. We don't have Uber around. So they decide to drive themselves home, and that's when they get into some real accidents. And so we see some interesting cases in trauma. We can see some, unfortunately, very tragic cases at night, too. With all that said, when I work night shift, which is, again, it's almost exclusively, it's a whole different ball game because my lifestyle has changed. I pretty much, like right now, we're recording this podcast in the late afternoon, early evening, because this is my prime time. This is when I'm up doing everything, and this is when I get to be productive. But not the rest of the world relies on this, unfortunately, and kind of ignores this fact, and a lot of things get scheduled early in the day. My favorite one is that 10 a.m. meeting that has to be done at 10 a.m. because that's the only time everyone else can go, because for whatever reason we can't do it in the afternoon. Also getting those calls from people, my colleagues, who know that I am sleeping right now at 10 a.m. and decide to give me a call anyway because they had a question that, even though it could have waited till I usually get up at about 3 or so, decide to call me then. That drives me nuts. I'm not calling you at 2 a.m., so please don't call me at 10 a.m.
I won't deny that I get some perverse pleasure from waking people up in the middle of the night. However, that being said, one of the things I picked up from attending the teaching course in New York City was don't be a dick. Not sure if I can say that, but you should try to be nice to your colleagues, coworkers, and even the patients that come in. We all have usually there's one provider and or nurse at your facility who will balk at a patient coming in for some what seems like minor complaint in the middle of the night. I prefer to look at it much like Louis Goldfrank, a legendary ER doc at Bellevue, and he sees emergency medicine as the last bastion of public health. So I don't mind that they come in at that hour of the night. It's fine with me, but I do totally agree with management's view of the night shift. And let's face it, there's a bit of a subculture that exists on the night shift. Those people tend to be more anti-establishment, anti-authority. They're not big meeting people, but they're very friendly people. They're practical people. They're street smart people. They're my kind of people.
I would not recommend anyone to do this on an actual interview. I did do this, though. Still got hired. That's a whole different story. But when I actually interviewed at a place, they asked me about, do you want to work night shift or do you want to work day shift? Do you have a preference? And I said, I'd rather work night shift. Now, keep in mind, I'm interviewing with administration. They said, well, that's odd. We usually don't have people who want to work night shift. I said, yeah, I hate red tape in administration. I'd rather work at night.
I'm sure they appreciated your honesty.
Really, I actually got hired pretty much right after that. So I thought, well, maybe it's good to be honest about your opinions.
Absolutely.
So I feel like that's one of the nice things about night shift is you do kind of practice a little more independently and autonomously. You do have to rely more on your wit and your resources, because when I have broken bones at night, for example, or I have other minor emergencies, not to say that they aren't important, but I'm not going to call about every little thing. I'm going to be wise about my options. Now, I'm at least going to usually, as a PA, going to consult with my emergency doc who's around, at least get the okay from them to do this. And most of the time they say, yeah, we should be fine. We'll just make sure they give a call in the morning or whatever else. So I try and give some leeway there, because, again, I don't want to be that person who's calling you for every little thing. And on the hospitalist side or the specialist side, I would like to remind you that there are a lot of patients we never call you about. So don't think that we're calling you for every little thing. At least most of us aren't doing that. I think we try and do a very good job of picking and choosing our patients who need to be consulted.
I think what we ought to try to do as more of a standard practice is to call the consultant once a shift and tell them about the patient that we're not calling them about, because I too sometimes feel that they think that we call them for everything, but certainly we manage a lot on our own. And as an aside on the night shift topic, I think it's important to remember how fatigue can affect your decision making. So the group ESNE I work with in southern Vermont, they're very attuned to this, and they try to work their shifts into smaller hours and smaller chunks. It's also important, if you're the solo provider in a rural place in the middle of the night, to know that you don't necessarily have to get to the bottom of everything, and it's okay to keep the patient there and just ops them in your ER overnight and let somebody well-caffeinated and fresh in the morning help you solve the problem.
Now, you bring up a great point there about that, and that's one of the reasons why I choose to do night shift and pretty much exclusively night shift. What it is like for a lot of people who are used to working different shifts, day, night, mids, whatever, there are going to be times that you're going to be less productive than others. By me being on the night shift, the day shift is my least productive period because I'm not as awake as usual, not as attentive as usual, and for me, I'm at my prime at night. I have changed my entire lifestyle to kind of help bring that up. Even on days I'm off, unless I'm off for a really long stretch, like to go to a conference, which, by the way, Fritz, if we can come up with the first nighttime conference at the medical conference, I am willing to get that started.
That's a great idea. I'm surprised that nobody has come up with that.
Well, I came up with a couple of different places to do this at. So Las Vegas, because everything is lit up at night anyway, right? And you know that's a natural place. There's how many emergency medicine conferences are in Las Vegas anyway? So yeah, we can always do Las Vegas. New York City, because you know it's the city that never sleeps, right?
Absolutely.
So I think those two are some pretty good options. I'm sure there's others out there. London. London never gets the credit for being an all-night place. When I spent my time overseas in London working there, it's really funny because I couldn't tell the people who were still up from the night before or really up early in the morning, and they all look the same. So I couldn't really tell that difference. And I think there's a lot of cities like that where you could actually have probably a nighttime conference. So if we can come up with that, if you have any ideas and you want to host a nighttime conference, let me know.
Certainly if the ski conferences can allow you to take off in the middle of the conference to go skiing, you could start the night conference at 7 or 8. Perhaps in your favorite pub-like environment, let it go for a few hours and then pick up later.
Can you talk to Mike about Castlefest at night? Maybe we can
I think they're always looking for new and innovative ways to deliver knowledge and information.
Well, there we go. We can start our own little sub-conference at Castlefest, the nighttime hours. Okay, so like I said, we filed our grievances. I think we came up with a couple of options there. One thing I'd just really like to remind people is that when you do have someone who works night shift, to please keep in mind their hours and to try not call them. Now, this is friends, family, coworkers, everyone. Just keep in mind, we're not calling you at that time. We're trying to do the same with your life as you're doing with our lives. So just please keep that in mind, just bare minimum. Now, Fritz actually has another thing he wanted to rant about, and that is about being an early adopter. Can you give us a story of one of those examples of being an early adopter and how some people just don't understand what the hell you're doing, and sometimes they take a little bit of extra convincing?
Absolutely. So when I was a paramedic, I used to carry around a black backpack. And over time, I realized that it was filled with articles, a lot of review articles and a lot of emergency medicine research, which was kind of novel for a paramedic. My partner used to joke whenever I would have a discussion with other paramedics that they need to be careful because that was the black bag of knowledge. And inside it was the repository of all medical knowledge, good and needed to be known by EMS. I think that's stuck with me. I had a patient recently that was suffering from cannabis hyperemesis syndrome, which, as you know, is becoming the new heroin plague, I believe, in certain parts of the country. I had thrown the pharmaceutical kitchen sink or Omnicell at the person, if you will, all the pain medicines, all the nausea medicines, everything I could think of, and nothing was working. One of the nurses I was working with suggested perhaps we should try some capsaicin cream. And I thought to myself, capsaicin cream, that's the stuff you use for pepper spray. And she's like, yes, but you don't necessarily have to pepper spray the patient. You could simply apply it to their belly, and there's been some reports that it might make it better. Of course, we didn't have any in the hospital, but our EMS crew was kind and gracious, swung by the retail pharmacy on the way back from a transfer, delivered us this tube of magic. We rubbed it on the patient's belly, and lo and behold, they got better. Sure, you may argue it's a placebo effect, but there is some small amount of literature that suggests there's a unique receptor that is affected by capsaicin. So the question is, do you become an early adopter or do you wait for more convincing evidence? I think certain times in clinical medicine, it's perfectly reasonable to try options that maybe have not been explored that well, but that have some sort of basis in reality, if you will.
So I think you bring up a great point, because with early adoption, there are always those people who are going to hold you back, who are going to be basically, as the pencil analogy goes, there's the people at the very tip of the pencil. You know, they're at the cutting edge. They're the ones who are basically coming up with the new ideas. Then you have the early adopters, who are more of like the area right behind the tip of the pencil. And then you're going to have those who accept the information earlier and then later as it goes. And what you don't want to be is, you don't want to be the butt end of the eraser. You don't want to be the back end, because everyone else has already done it and they're trying to convince you to do the same thing. Early adoption, depending on your hospital, I feel like with academic centers, sometimes it's a little bit easier with, or the really rural areas, because you don't have many resources. So you sometimes have to try the things that are a little different than usual. But one of the hardest things I have with this sometimes, and it's not because I can't prove it, because I try and make sure if I do anything new, if I am an early adopter for something, I have good research to back it up. So if no one questions it, it's actually trying to get the skeptical person or the person who really doubts those abilities or those possibilities to even get me there to begin with. Because, you know, if anything doesn't work out quite right, or even if everything does go perfect, someone's still going to turn around and say, why did you do that? And they're not always going to ask it in the nicest way.
This is very true, and dogma slaying is definitely not for the faint of heart. I've worked in places that still believe that the best way to manage a wound is to just go ahead and dunk it in a big pile of betadine and let it soak for 20 minutes. So I think the slaying of dogma occurs on a one-by-one basis, so I'll usually try to approach that person and try to get at the heart of why they believe this to be true. And if they're receptive, it's easy to show them the literature and the evidence. But sometimes it is indeed very difficult to break the dogma.
I feel like a couple of things that can be huge tips for this. Make sure you have an ally early. Have someone who works with you, a colleague of yours, especially one that's well-respected, and go through this with them. Because I feel like having a well-respected and well-known colleague back you up is very helpful for your cause. That, and of course, have the actual research too. There, I can't tell you the number of times, this is kind of funny, when I have someone who says, are you sure you can do that? He said, yeah, I've got research to back it up. If you want, I can show it to you. And they say, oh, no. And early on, I had a couple of nurses who would question me on every little thing I did, every little thing, whether or not it had, you know, it was kind of well known or not. And so what I did early on was I printed off all these papers. Whenever they asked me a question, I turn around, I give them the paper and said, well, you can look at this paper. And half the time, at least half the time, they'd say, oh, no, I trust you. I'm like, no, you don't. You don't really. You're skeptical of this. Read this paper, and then we can talk about it later. And we can see if you come up with the same conclusions I do. And so I'm not trying to be a dick about it, but I am trying to say that, hey, you really do kind of need to keep up with the stuff. The more you rely on other people to tell you what to do, especially in the world of medicine where it's constantly evolving, the further behind you're going to get. And so that doesn't mean you have to practice every new little thing. As we've talked about on our website and others, Ketafall is a little bit in the downfall right now. Now, it indeed may still have some benefits. There may still be certain patients who will benefit from a combination of ketamine and propofol, but not all patients. We're kind of discovering that maybe this magical combination is not as good as we originally thought. But there are definitely some patients who may still have a benefit from it. It's just trying to figure out which ones that is. So for me, early adoption is not a bad thing. But when I do it with a patient, if there's something that's still relatively new, not only do I want to have someone on my side who also is helping provide care for patients, but I also want the patient on my side. I want to explain to the patient that this may still be a relatively new technique. Sometimes when I have, especially if I have a patient who says, oh, I've never seen anyone do this before, I've never heard of anyone doing it this way, I make sure and I spend an extra couple of minutes talking to them about this and making sure that they're comfortable with it too. Because someone may say, no, I'd just rather have what everyone else does to me. I know that works. And as long as it's something that's still safe and practical, I'll entertain that more. But I will talk to them about, hey, there are benefits of using a newer technique or method. And a lot of people are more willing to do that.
I think a great example there is the idea of using the isopropyl alcohol wipes for nausea control.
Yes.
It's certainly, in terms of a cost benefit, it's not invasive. It's already laying around the department. You know, what harm could possibly be done by having them sniff this? And in fact, some good may come from it. When I do the same thing with other providers and all the staff that helps us, if they seem hesitant, I actually use a free product called Mendeley, where I store all these articles, and I'll just take my portable device and I'll shoot them the article right away. But I do it in a self-effacing manner, you know, just say, look, I'm not that smart, and I actually didn't even read this article. I just kind of looked at the title. But if you read it, I bet you're going to find some good stuff in here that backs up this practice.
That's a good point. And it sounds a little facetious when you say, are you actually reading these papers still, or are you just really just looking at the title and the abstract?
I actually do try to read the paper the whole way through. But, you know, I, like you said, it's important to have allies. It's important to not come across as being the arrogant know-it-all. And I'm very humble about medicine. We had discussed earlier the early adoption philosophies. I used to be, when I was a medic, I believed that there was absolute clear-cut ways in which to, you know, skin this cat or practice medicine. But boy, after 30 years, I've realized there's a lot of great, equally appropriate approaches to the problems that we face every day in the emergency department.
And that's something else to keep in mind as an early adopter, or for someone who's working with an early adopter, is that we're not necessarily saying that this is the greatest way to do this or the best way. It's just that this is what the newest information shows and it has promise, but sometimes it needs to be later validated to make sure it's true. And so you need to know your comfort level and also your patient's comfort level and your colleagues about, are we all on the same page? You know, as we were mentioning earlier, is TXA something that's being practiced everywhere? Not everyone is using TXA yet. They probably should be, but not everyone's using it yet. Another great example, you brought up the using alcohol wipes for nausea. One common thing I'm using a lot, not just that, but is another good example of early adoption, is using dilute apple juice instead of Pedialyte for kids with, you know, basically gastroenteritis symptoms. I've had a lot of people who were at first wondering about that, but I'm thinking, like, have you ever asked most of the people who think that they should be doing Pedialyte still, I asked them if they ever tasted it. And most people will actually say no. And it's kind of funny when you have them taste it and then compare it to apple juice, why you understand kids are more willing to drink apple juice versus Pedialyte most of the time.
Right, and certain things have just face value to them, you know, face validity, where you look at that and you say, boy, you know, that just makes a lot of sense. I don't need a large randomized controlled trial to tell me that this tastes better than that. And if I give it to two kids in the waiting room, we can kind of tell where the preferences will be. It always impressed me with the pediatricians who knew what all the different formulations of prednisone and prednisolone tasted like.
And I should mention here real quick, as always, no conflicts of interest. We're not endorsing or trying not to endorse anything in particular. It's just kind of what the research shows.
Absolutely.
So it's okay, Pedialyte. We're not picking on you on purpose. So otherwise, I think we kind of hit a good couple of subjects here. Sounds like we've hit the first part. Hopefully, you all will like our roll rants and our tales from the holler, and we'll get to see Fritz back here some more. He's been a lot of fun. He does have a different accent than I do. Not too different, but a little bit.
Yeah, and Chip, it's great to be on. I know that there's a large group of us rural emergency medicine PAs, nurse practitioners, who enjoy all the big podcasts, but it's nice to have one of our own ranks doing it, especially from a more rural perspective.
Yes, and that reminds me, if anyone has any ideas for upcoming podcasts, if there's certain things you want us to rant about, or maybe you even want to come on and help us rant about, or if you have interesting topics you wish for us to discuss more about, just let us know. We're always happy to entertain that. We do get quite a bit of positive feedback, so we appreciate every little bit of that. I guess we should call that a wrap. Until next time, continue to provide total care everywhere.